Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Christopher Bram, whose latest book is Eminent Outlaws, The Gay Writers Who Changed America. Christopher Bram is the author of 9 books of fiction, including Father of Frankenstein, which became Gods and Monsters, the film. Most recent is Exiles in America, also a collection of essays, Mapping the Territory. Eminent Outlaws tells the story of gay writing, gay male writing in particular, in America, and parallels it with the story of gay rights in America because you can't separate the two. I understand this began exactly that way, that a writer named Sam Wasson approached you doing research on the film Breakfast at Tiffany's, and you proceeded to give him the full story that's in this book, only a little bit more condensed. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I was kind of thinking about, what should I write next? I was looking for a nonfiction project. I'd written 9 novels. I was looking for something new. I get a phone call one day from Sam Wasson, who was referred to me by a mutual friend, and he wanted to know information about Breakfast at Tiffany's, the literary world, about the novel. And why does Truman Capote, why is he present there, but we don't know his sexuality, it's kind of just kind of left blank. What was going on in gay literature at the time? So I told him, I talked to him about half an hour, just telling him about Capote and Vidal and Baldwin and some of the other people. And afterwards he said, wow, this is great stuff. Where can I read this? And I realized no such book existed. And it needed to exist. It deserved to exist. So I began work on this one.
You made a decision, even though you try to make it as broad as possible, you do focus in on specific people, Truman Capote, Gore Vidal, Tennessee Williams, Christopher Isherwood, Allen Ginsberg, James Baldwin, and later Larry Kramer and Edmund White. Were there other writers that you were thinking of incorporating, but they became kind of secondary players?
Not really. Always I had planned it as just doing a handful, maybe a dozen at the most, writers. I mean, what was surprising is that once I began working on it, I did add a couple of new ones. I'm looking back, I'm amazed I did not include Christopher Isherwood in the original proposal. But I get to, Gore Vidal goes out to Hollywood, he meets Isherwood, I realize, this is how he ties into the story. Isherwood, for me, became one of the heroes of the book. He was more open and out and saner than the other members of his generation. He was a little older than they were, too, but he ended up, for me, doing some of the greatest work.
I interviewed Arthur Lawrence about World War II gay life. Your book starts pretty much where that whole era ends, which means that post-war, something really did change. What do you think that was?
A couple of things were happening. One is, during World War II, all these gay men and women who had been kind of living alone in different small towns in different states all over the country were thrown into the Army or the Navy, and they met each other. And they discovered they were not alone, that there were huge numbers of them. And they came back from the war with not quite gay consciousness, but they were not alone. We are a people. And they were curious. They wanted to know more. Meanwhile, the publishing industry discovered, we can write about other things. The censorship rules loosened up. Again, people, because of their experiences in the Army, their exposure to profanity, their exposure to sex, were much more open and curious than they'd been before. And so they wanted books about that. Right after World War II, you suddenly have this books with more sex, straight sex as well as gay sex. I mean, before then, it was harder to write about any kind of sex. And suddenly you have sex in the books published by mainstream publishers. And it just kind of produced this brief outburst of gay books that the most famous are City and the Pillar and Other Voices, Other Room, which coincidentally were published like within weeks of the Kinsey Report coming out in 1948. There have been a couple of other gay titles like the year or so before from mainstream houses. Before that, there were occasional gay books, but usually published by small presses, distributed privately. Better Angel by Foreman Brown is the first one that comes to mind. There's a couple of others like that, but not published by mainstream houses and widely distributed the way these books were after World War II.
Somewhere in there also is a book called The Gallery.
Published the year before. Interesting, Gore Vidal wrote City and the Pillar. Nobody had been writing about this. He thought it was a great subject. His own editor didn't know he was gay. He didn't know he was writing out of his own experience. Vidal finished the book and wanted them to publish it quickly before somebody else beat him to it. And when John Hornburns published The Gallery, Vidal was right, okay, this is what I was afraid of. I knew somebody else would cover the subject before I did. But it was Vidal who got more attention. The Gallery is an amazing novel. It still holds up really well. Vidal was a big fan of John Hornburns. He was a big fan of several other writers. He's famous more for his feuds, particularly his feud with Truman Capote, but he was very supportive of his friends, Christopher Isherwood, John Hornburns, Tennessee Williams, and would write about them very intelligently and even lovingly.
Capote and Vidal had their own little friendship slash feud during that period. You focus on Capote, yet his gay output was fairly minimal.
It was minimal, but there's a lot going on between the lines. His first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms, is in a way his gayest book. It's like this southern gothic fairy tale set in the 1930s, in this very real South of the 1930s. It's a lot about atmosphere, but there is a major gay subplot in it. His cousin Randolph is gay, and Randolph is still in love with a Mexican boxer, which he talks about. I mean, other people later on projected other things onto the book that aren't there. I mean, primarily because when the book was published, it had a famous photograph of Truman Capote on the back, lying supine on a sofa, like with a climb on me look in his eyes, that became notorious. And several reviewers reviewed not the book but the photograph, arguing this book he's trying to justify his homosexuality, which isn't really true. There's a real gay subplot in there that he did address. He got a lot of abuse for the book. He got a lot of praise, too. People appreciated there's something special going on here. This is a new voice. The prose here is beautiful. The sensibility is kind of wonderful. But he did get attacked for being gay. They just assumed he was gay based on the photograph more than anything else.
Is that the photograph that's here on the cover?
That's a different one. About from the same time. He was – all these major photographers took his picture. It's funny just how many – Henri Cartier-Bresson, there's a great picture. I can't remember who took the one on the cover.
Reading your book, Christopher Bram, it struck me that in those days, right up, I guess, into the 70s, maybe even into the 80s, what I was never aware of, but it's so stark, is the homophobia in the literary critical community. It just shocked me.
It was poisonous. Going back and reading through the reviews for me was eye-opening. I knew there was some negative feeling, but not when you read review after review from smart people, from well-read intellectuals who felt free to speak so abusively of gay men and women. It was bizarre. It really wore me down after a while. I include maybe only two-thirds of what I read. I don't include all of it, but it became poisonous after a time.
The critics that I had respected, people like Walter Kerr and Stanley Kaufman and Vincent Canby, writing about theater and film, I mean, their homophobia was striking.
Really, really strong. Just, it jumps off the page. And Elizabeth Hardwick, in the course of what was otherwise a good review of A Single Man, it has this sort of condescending, sneering tone about the main gay character in there that's coming from Elizabeth Hardwick. She should know better.
During that period, during the 40s, 50s, into the 60s, what we now call the mainstream press or conventional wisdom was extremely homophobic to a point where until, I guess, Stonewall and thereafter, it was very, very difficult for any gay writer, whether they were writing about straight people or gay people, to get good press.
Edward Albee's an interesting case in point. Albee wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It actually got great reviews when it opened. It was like, oh, wow, somebody is telling the truth about marriage, how the kind of fights and the anger and the games people play. The critics loved it. Within a year, maybe a little longer, word got out that Albee was gay, and the same critics turned against the play, saying, oh, this isn't really about us. This is about a bunch of gay men, and some of them are in drag, which is nonsense. It's about straight people. It's, as Albee himself said, gay couples and straight couples, we all fight the same way. And he's right. But the kind of abuse toward that play and towards Albee continued until, interestingly enough, it might be just coincidence, but the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, opened. And here you have the world's most famous straight couple delivering these powerhouse lines to each other. Nobody said this was two gay men anymore. They couldn't anymore without looking ridiculous.
Was there any blowback at that time toward Tennessee Williams? Suddenly people were examining Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or Streetcar in a different way?
Yeah, Williams caught a lot of abuse, too. At the same time, Albee did. The straight establishment realized two of our major playwrights are gay men, Tennessee Williams and Edward Albee. Arthur Miller was still working. They knew he was straight for sure. He'd just come out with After the Fall, which doesn't succeed. It's a really ambitious project that doesn't work. And it was, oh, my God, our best playwrights are gay. What does that say about us? So they went after Tennessee Williams, too.
Is it possible, just in thinking, that Albee's decision to write a play that was so anti-religion and anti-conventional wisdom like Tiny Alice could have been kind of a screw you to critics?
It was a screw you to critics. It was something strange was going on there, and critics didn't know what to make of it. I mean, some of them gave it the benefit of the doubt. Philip Roth, of all people, tore into it in the New York Review of Books and accuses it of being full of ghastly pansy rhetoric, was his line. And I think he really didn't understand what the play was about. Even now it's hard to tell. So he was assuming, oh, this was written by a gay man. He's doing something at our expense, which isn't true. He wanted to write a pure theater of the absurd play.
Christopher Bram, you focus on poetry, Allen Ginsberg in particular, even though there wasn't really much after Howl. Why did you decide to stay focused on Ginsberg?
Howl was a major poem, very, very important in the story. I still think it's his best poem. I mean, it remains strong. It remains really powerful. And what he wrote afterwards, very little of it comes even close. But it was such an important piece of the story, both the poem itself and the amount of attention it got nationwide when it was seized in San Francisco and it went to trial. The national coverage is fascinating. It sold well nationwide, and poetry very rarely sells well. Once I established I need to follow Ginsberg a little more, and I'm still kind of puzzled over, so why is his later work? There's a good poem here and there, but not that much. I speculate he might have been too happy to write good poetry anymore. But he was important in the 50s. What he wrote in the 50s remained important, but he wrote almost nothing as good or as important later on. He did a really nice poem about In Memory of Frank O'Hara, which I quote from. And there's a couple of others, but nothing of the caliber of Howl.
Well, you do focus a bit on poets themselves, including James Merrill, who Edmund White talks about in City Boy and under a pseudonym in his novels.
Yeah.
You don't really talk at all about genre fiction. Is it that you're not that familiar with genre fiction?
That's part of the story. I could only follow so many storylines in the book. And once I established kind of literary fiction and theater and poetry as the main threads to follow, I here and there allude to genre writing that I really like. Michael Nava, his Henry Rios novels, which I think are quite amazing. They work as both detective fiction, and together they work as a sort of Bildungsroman about this character, Henry Rios. I mean, there's others that I know are out there, but I just never found a way to quite work them into the story. I'm telling, like, one set of stories that can be told about this larger narrative. I mean, it's like the subject itself is like this mountain. I chose a couple of paths over it. There's other paths that I hope other people write.
You say the writers who changed America, but there was one British writer whose book was on the shelves in the late 80s and into the 90s who you don't mention at all, and that's Allan Hollinghurst.
Mm-hmm. I'm certainly aware of him. I've read his first three novels twice. I never found a way to really work him in. I was talking about in sales and bookstores and put his presence there, but he was not part of the larger strands. But yeah, no, he writes beautifully, beautiful prose. And he received more attention from the mainstream press than a lot of American gay writers did.
Well, Line of Beauty won the Booker Prize, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even in the United States, he gets reviewed and taken seriously in a way that's harder for American writers.
It took Edmund White a long, long time to make that transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that also brings up something else, which is that gay literature, gay films, now we still have gay genre films, which you can find on Netflix, but gay literature, gay plays, it seems that the genre, just as the genres of fantasy and science fiction and mysteries have almost been subsumed by the mainstream, the gay genre has as well.
Yes and no. I mean, it's still really good gay work being produced. It's not getting as much attention as it did. Gay work was ignored for the longest time. It was kind of existed in its own underground. Even in the 70s into the 80s, a lot of the books I talk about were not reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. They were sold by word of mouth in gay bookstores. Gay and lesbian bookstores are kind of a major part of this story. I don't think what's happened recently is not so much that they've been made part of the mainstream. A couple of writers are kind of accepted, Edmund White, Armistead Mope, and Alan Hollinghurst. But in a way, there's still good writers, good new writers who are producing work, but it's not being published by mainstream houses. It's not being recognized by the mainstream presses. Smaller presses are having to put them out.
That's partly due to the decline and fall of the midlist.
I mean,
you have your collection of essays was published by a gay and lesbian press, Allison, and Edmund White's recent collection of pieces from the New York Review of Books is also published by a small publisher.
Yeah, published by Magnus.
Yeah. That may have more to do with just general trends in publishing than anything else.
No, I agree. It's what's happening in publishing rather than acceptance or assimilation of gay culture into the mainstream.
Christopher Bram, when I was thinking about being a novelist before I stopped thinking about being a novelist, I was warned about the really nasty politics within the gay literature world itself. Have you found that to be true?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I actually find it's more supportive than anything else. Oh, there are a few bitchy writers, but or even if they're kind of secretly fuming or competitive, they have too much of a sense of dignity to go public with it. They don't want their animosity to show. They don't want their envy to show. Actually, I find it's more supportive than anything else.
We've already talked about how you were surprised by the critics and their reaction. What did you learn in doing the research for this that you had absolutely no idea about?
The biggest revelation was the critics, the just sheer volume of negativity, but also learned, in a way, how recent the change has been. The story begins in 1948. This is a kind of steady building of pressure going on for about three decades until the end of the 60s, even into the early 70s. And it's not really until the late 70s that the big change in gay writers being able to tell their stories without fear. And slowly but surely after that, the mainstream recognizing gays as equal takes place. The gay revolution is much more recent than we think.
It also seems as if somewhere along the line, maybe I'm wrong, that doing this research and doing this homework, your opinion may have shifted about Larry Kramer.
Yes, it did. How does one begin? Larry can be a real pain. Almost all of us have mixed feelings about Larry. Some days we love him and then we hate him. My initial editor, when I said I want to include Larry Kramer in the story, he says, "Oh, God, I'm tired of Larry Kramer. Do you have to?" And I thought, he's an important part of the story. He's a really interesting character. He's not boring. But then once I started kind of writing the story, you're right, and seeing how his importance to the story, his importance as a character, I took him more seriously as a writer. Going back and rereading The Normal Heart for maybe like the fourth time, this play really holds up. It's not just of its time. It has this meaning and importance beyond the moment when it was written. So, yes, I came away having a much kind of stronger pro-Kramer feeling, although then after that he continues to misbehave. I mean, I report there's things he did. His attack on Ed White's novel Farewell Symphony before it was published, I'm still baffled. Why did he do that? And I'm not convinced he even read the book. There was the animosity there that just kind of spilled over.
How do you think gay marriage is going to change literature? Will it?
I think it'll give us a whole new subject to write about. Although, well, probably the really exciting new subject will be gay divorce. as we get into this kind of legal tangles, divorce is a subject I think just kind of revolutionized post-war straight literature. I mean, can you imagine Saul Bellow without divorce? It'll give Gaylord a whole new subject. Maybe more for the comedies than not. It's a great subject. I mean, marriage is a great subject. Jane Austen never tired of it, nor did Anthony Trollope, and I think we'll see that with gay literature, too.
If there were anything that struck me other than learning about new writers in this book and the critics, as you said, it was the amount of autobiography that actually appears in novels. I interview writers, and I tend to think of a work of fiction as fiction. But when it comes to someone like Edmund White, or perhaps you with your first book, Surprising Myself, how should we look at some of these books?
There's always going to be an element of autobiography there, even if it's symbolic autobiography, allegorical autobiography. I mean, my first novel, Surprising Myself, is, I mean, it's a kid who has one older sister and his parents are divorced, his father's with the CIA, completely unlike my family. The father's very irresponsible. Interestingly enough, though, after my mother read it, she said, "Where did that father come from?" And I said, "Well, he's nothing like Dad." She said, I know. Why did you need to imagine such a father?" And she was right. It was coming out of that. My father was very responsible, very serious man, and I wanted to imagine a bad father.
Well, what about the story of the coming out itself and the way you dealt with it? Was there autobiography there?
Good question. Not really. It was a bit different. I've never stopped to think about that. How much? There's no autobiography there. There is autobiography in most of the book is about this gay couple deciding how they want to live, and one of them wants to fool around on the side. There's a lot of autobiography in that. I've since had readers tell me they hated that section because my character was using the same excuses they did.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because so much of Edmund White's work winds up to be autobiography, to the point where you can point a finger, you know, rather than saying, this is a composite, which is what you normally get, you wind up pointing and say, oh, that's James Merrill, oh, that's so-and-so, that's so-and-so.
White is a very autobiographical writer, so that it's interesting how he's telling his story again. He did it once with the trilogy, with Boy's Own Story, Beautiful Room is Empty, and Farewell Symphony. Then with a kind of epilogue to that, A Married Man. And now he's going back and telling it again, this time as real autobiography sometimes, although the newest novel, Jack Holmes and His Friend, is back into autobiography. He is his favorite subject, and it's a great subject, and he keeps finding new ways to tell it.
What was strange for me was reading City Boy, the autobiography, after reading the novel, Jack Holmes and His Friend, and seeing, again, pointing to certain characters, which you make more explicit in Eminent Outlaws, exactly what is autobiography there. You start wondering about that line between fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, it's a very porous line. And sometimes it can work in his favor. I've never been able to read or enjoy Caracol, his sort of fantasy novel. But this time I read it knowing how much autobiography was tucked away in it, at reading it in the course of writing about him, and suddenly it became interesting. It still doesn't work. It still is this gorgeous experiment, this kind of the Baroque prose, and it still doesn't work, but it becomes more interesting and it's readable. I mean, Keith McDermott, who has appeared, actor friend of Ed White's, who has appeared in many different books, appears here as a female courtesan actress. He later told Ed White's nephew, "Well, at least you got to stay your sex. I had to change my gender."
Christopher Bram, you have 9 novels, each of them somewhat different. Some of them, I guess, Lives of the Circus Animals or Exile in America might have a little bit more autobiography than some of the others. One of your books was Father of Frankenstein, which became the movie Gods and Monsters. What drew you to the director, James Whale?
I loved the movies and had always been intrigued by them. I've been thinking for years that I would like to write a novel about a gay movie director. How much of his gay life ends up in the movies, is it relevant at all? At one point, I was thinking about doing a novel about F.W. Murnau, the German director who made Nosferatu. But one day, I was kind of sitting down with a friend, a British friend, a documentary filmmaker, who loved James Whale as much as I did. And he knew a couple of things about Whale that I didn't, his working-class background and his service in World War I. I knew a couple of things about Whale that Brian didn't know. And we started talking about how one would go about doing a documentary about James Will, because there's no footage of him at work. There's only a few photographs. And I proposed, why don't you do this fictional framework? It's the end of James Whale's life, and you have an actor playing James Whale, and then you kind of incorporate a narrator and still photographs, and you tell the story in a conventional manner within that fictional framework. We both found that idea very exciting. I went home, wrote up my notes, and then went back to work at the novel I was working on at the time. And about a year later, I needed another project, and I thought of the James Whale story. Actually, my partner, when I told him the idea for the documentary, he said, I don't know, it sounds more like a novel to me. The story wouldn't go away, and I thought, well, maybe I should try it as a novel. So I wrote to Brian, asked, do you mind if I use those ideas we talked about for a novel? And he said, go ahead, they were your ideas. And I'm having the damnedest time making it this documentary because nobody knows who James Whale is. So maybe you can get enough attention for Whale that I can do my documentary. So then I began work on what was then called Father of Frankenstein.
And how did Gods and Monsters, the film, come about then?
Happy accident. The director, Bill Condon, read the book. I think he read, got reviewed in the New York Times book review. He loves James Whale. He got the book, read it, thought, oh, this could work as a movie. And so he contacted my agent. I get this phone call from my agent saying, there's a director who's interested. His last movie was Candyman 2. And I thought, oh, well, okay, some good directors have begun in lowly genres. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to talk to him. I watched Candyman 2, which is a slasher film, but actually is pretty good, about racial guilt and fear, and it's kind of worked out in slasher movie terms. It was clearly done by somebody who knew what they were doing. So then after Bill optioned the book, we started talking by phone, and we hit it off instantly. We spoke the same language. He had some ideas about different ways to take the film than where the novel went, and I thought they were good ideas. And we just hit it off very well.
And Ian McKellen came on board pretty quickly then?
I'm proud to say Ian McKellen was my idea. After I'd finished the book, before the novel came out, saw the movie 6 Degrees of Separation, where Ian McKellen played a friend from South Africa. And I'd seen McKellen in other films, but usually he was played these kind of sinister, chilly type figures. But here he was kind of warm and quiet, and he looked a little like James Whale. And so I told Bill, what about Ian McKellen for James Whale? And Bill thought, okay, that's interesting. Let me look into that. Bill then approached Ian McKellen, and McKellen initially said no, because here's a story about a gay man who commits suicide. McKellen said, with my politics, I can't play such a role. Bill said, read the script again, and you'll see that what's really going on. It's not about that. And he did, and he changed his mind, and he came aboard. And, wow, to hear your dialogue read by Ian McKellen is just heaven.
Was he out of the closet at the time?
He was out.
He was out.
He had come out on actually the end of the 80s, I think, in like 88. He came out after a conversation with Armistead Maupin. Maupin and his partner at the time were complaining about celebrities in the closet, and they were going on, and McKellen is good friends with both, and he says, do you think I should come out? And they said, yes, we do. And they thought nothing would come of it, and a few minutes later, on the radio in Britain, Ian came out.
Well, a lot of people have come out since, and yet stereotypes in the mainstream, even in recent TV shows like Smash, persist.
Part of it is the stereotypes, some of them are a lot of fun, and really smart actors and writers can take the stereotypes and begin with them and then turn them inside out. But when they don't, they just become tired and stale and boring and offensive.
I have mixed feelings about this. If gay people are fully accepted, then on the one hand, great, there's acceptance, everything's mm-hmm. fine. On the other hand, does the culture begin to just drift away?
I don't think so. There's always something different. There's always that different point of view. It will get more twists and turns. If oppression was good for us, we would all want to be oppressed. We would think we would kind of encourage everyone, black, white, female, gay, straight, to suffer some kind of oppression will make you a better person. But I think the removal of oppression, a degree of acceptance, is going to change things. But the difference is going to remain, and people will have fun with the difference or explore it or do different things with it. One of the writers that I read with in New York last week, Rekhi Sital, who's Indian from Cincinnati, was telling me us about he had just come back from a gay Super Bowl party. And I, okay, that's different. That's new. I wouldn't want to go, but I liked it. He said everybody, they talked during the game and were quiet only during the commercials.
Christopher Brehm, did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, I did. Strangely enough, from high school on, I just enjoyed writing. I just enjoyed taking out a notebook and getting a pencil and filling up pages with dialogue spoken by people who didn't even exist.
When it came time to really get down to it, did you feel any level of self-censorship at all in your early writing regarding being gay?
I assumed initially I couldn't write about it. This was in the mid-70s, and I thought I couldn't write about it, so I have to write about other things. So I wrote a novel about a circle of straight friends after college who drink too much and sleep with each other's opposite sex partners too much. Worked on it for 7 years, went through multiple drafts, and was never able to publish it. So after that, I decided when I began my next novel, I thought, well, this new novel might not be published either, so I might as well write what I really want to write, which became Surprising Myself, which was my gay novel. But until I had spent 7 years trying to be normal in this other book, I failed. I thought, I might as well write what I really want to write.
Well, what were you doing at the time to make money?
First, I was working as a night clerk at a Ramada Inn in Williamsburg, Virginia. Then I moved to New York and was working with the Social Security Administration, living out in Flushing. I was terrible at my job. It was pre-computer terminal days. It was key punch cards. I could never figure out how to do it right. They asked me to resign. I was able to collect unemployment, and I then started Surprising Myself, the novel that finally got published. And I wrote most of that while I was working at Scribner's Bookstore for 7 years. Working at a bookstore was my equivalent of going to grad school.
And at that point, that's when you began meeting the writers, I would guess.
Yes. Early on, I published a short story in Christopher Street, and I would meet some of the writers and editors there. I didn't really meet them until after I became published. I wasn't published until, like, 1987.
Then in succession, you wrote a book every other year for several years.
Yeah. The seven-year straight novel that I couldn't publish, and then 7 years to write Surprising Myself. It was like I had all this built-up energy, so I was writing these books very quickly. And very happily, I really enjoy kind of trying different subjects, exploring different areas.
But there was still gay content in all of the
books. Yeah.
You're never going to go too far away. Do you think a gay writer can?
They can briefly, I think. If they're away from it for too long, I think they suffer. The batteries go dead. Writing fiction is so close to the body, is so kind of close to our skin, that a gay writer needs to write about gay life now and then. Not constantly. He can write about other things, too. All my books include mixed straight characters in there. I mean, Father of Frankenstein had this straight man, this Clay Boone. Hardest thing in the world to write, a straight man in the 1950s. It was really difficult. I had to work really hard at that.
In reading all of Eminent Outlaws, if you were to recommend, like, three books that people could read from the periods you talk about that are not quite as well known as the standard books on a gay bookshelf, what would they be?
Another Country by James Baldwin. I mean, most people will read Giovanni's Room for Baldwin. Another Country mixes gay and straight, black and white. It's kind of a mess sometimes, the prose, but there's this great emotional energy to it. It's a very powerful book, very moving, and it takes risks. Another Country is Love. I mean, he's recognizing how vulnerable love can make one and why people pull back from it, and he's exploring that.
You talk a lot about the fact that his gayness has virtually been excised. People forget that he was a gay man who wrote about gay people.
No, which is surprising. I mean, his essays are almost always about race and class and politics. He very rarely gets into sexuality. But his fiction, especially his early fiction, is very much about homosexuality, which he wrote about very well. I teach at NYU, and I mentioned James Baldwin was in this book to my students. They were going, he's gay? I didn't know. So it has been successfully excised. I mean, it makes people nervous, so they kind of draw back from it.
And what other books?
Down There on a Visit by Christopher Isherwood. Again, his most famous book is A Single Man. It's a great novel and works so much better than the movie did. But Down There on a Visit is a more epic. It's stories from a man's life. Again, the narrator is Christopher Isherwood. We don't know much about him, but we know about his friends, which include many gay men, and the kind of political choices. It follows Isherwood from his youth visit in the 1920s through Europe in the 30s and the coming of Hitler to, most amazingly, California in the late 1940s. And it's gets into his spirituality and his experiments with that, his kind of experiments with sexuality, too. It's an amazing book. It's very rich. It's hard to kind of say it's not really about just one thing. It's about many things. But there's a great sense of place in these different stories.
And a third book?
A third book. The Night Listener by Armistead Maupin. It's apart from his Tales of the City series. It's, again, surprisingly autobiographical. It's probably more autobiographical than his other work. And it's about the friendship that developed between him and what he thought was a teenage boy with AIDS who he knew only over the telephone. And it is an exploration of the kind of stories we tell, true and false, to give our lives meaning and the dangers of some of those stories.
You made a decision in Eminent Outlaws not to discuss lesbian literature. And that's because you don't know too much about it?
No, I don't know as well as gay men's literature. I admit that. It also, I realized early on, has a different type of arc. It runs parallel to gay men's, but it doesn't have the same shape. There's a kind of stop-and-go quality to it. It didn't build the way the gay men's literature did. It's a more difficult story to tell, and I think it would really require a woman to tell it well.
And is there any book out there even remotely like that that tells that story, you think?
I don't think so. The Wide Sea of Women back in the 90s, which had some really, but she focused on just four or five women novelists. That's the only one I can think of. There's Jane Rule, who's an amazing writer. I love some of her books from early on, did a really interesting book called Lesbian Images, where she did essays on different lesbian writers from Willa Cather up to, I think she includes herself at the end. But those are the only ones I can think of.
And today, here we are in 2012. Social issues in politics faded for a while. They seem back, but I don't think people really care. We have gay marriage now in, like, around, I don't know, 8 states. Where do you see this going?
It's amazing that this late in the day we can still have enemies. But they do seem, the enemy, everybody acknowledges the enemies are, they're dinosaurs. They are like throwbacks to another era. So I don't know where that leaves us without them. If everything was hunky-dory and we were going into Eden, I wouldn't know what to make of that. So these holdovers, in a way, I'm kind of grateful for them, that some enemies are still with us. But in polls, in conversations with friends, almost every straight person now has gay friends. It's hard to demonize us the way you cannot demonize us the way we once were. In a way, now we're free to be as boring or as wonderful as everybody else. It's a different type of challenge.
Christopher Bram, what are you working on now?
Working on a couple of nonfiction projects, just kind of exploring. It's too soon to talk about them. I've been making notes and discussing them with my agent and an editor, but I'm kind of just exploring right now.
And by that, you mean full-length books on specific topics?
Yeah. I really enjoyed writing this book. I enjoyed writing nonfiction. It's like I got to use a whole other side of my brain.
And do you have other essays which you can collect in a second volume?
I have written some more essays, but take a few more years to assemble. I mean, that first collection, Mapping the Territory, that was about like 20 years worth of essays, dating back to my time writing for Christopher Street Magazine.
And what do you think the role of blogs now plays in gay literature, or has it yet to play a role?
I think it definitely plays a role. It gets the word out in the way magazines used to and don't anymore. I mean, now they overlap. There's many magazines that people know more on the web than they do in physical shape. And then the blogs kind of add to that. And there are a couple of good ones. There's Queer Type, which Jameson Currier does. There's Band of Thieves, which Stephen Bottom does. And I'm constantly discovering whole new ones. Queer Reading, done by Dean Motor. Like once a month, he will write a review of a book. and they're very smart, well-considered reviews.
You've been listening to an interview with Christopher Bram, whose latest book is titled Eminent Outlaws, The Gay Writers Who Changed America. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.